Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are in the middle of what we are loosely calling Necra Month as we review all of the original appearances of the characters Necra and Mandrill on my show. It's a 7-part Steve Gerber story from the early 70s that is wild. There are moments in every one of these issues that I'm just like, holy shit, how did that make it onto the page? Today's episode certainly has some of those. In the latter half of today's episode, we're going to be reviewing Daredevil number 110 with the rather problematic title of Birthright. Again, we'll get there. I'm so excited to be recording an episode I've been anticipating for quite some time with three incredible professionals who worked on the wonderful show X-Men 97. We've had the chance to have a few X-Men 97 professionals on the show this month, including Jerry Gaylord and the voices of Sunspot and Bishop. Today we get some of the bigwigs, the people behind the scenes doing the major work, and I'm so thrilled to have you all here. Let me have you each introduce yourselves. Let us know your name and pronouns and a little about your biography. And then I've got an intro question for each of you. Let's begin with Sean Genka. Sean, welcome to Grey Malkin Lane.
Thank you, Chad. I'm super excited to be doing this. I've been, you know, interested in wanting to sit and chat old school comics with you since we met like almost a year ago.
Yeah, we met at the Uncanny Experience last year and became pretty fast friends. I took Sean to his first gay bar.
It's true.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, it's good times. Almost made it to my first shower show too.
Yeah, I was like, this is we kind of gave our shot.
But yeah, so I'm Sean Genka. I am the producer of X-Men 97. My pronouns are he, him. Let's see, I have been working in animation now for just over 15 years. I started on a show called Legend of Korra, that I also know is wonderfully popular within the LGBTQ plus and ally community, and I love that about that show. And then on to another one, The Loud House over at Nickelodeon, which is one of the first representations at Nickelodeon of a gay couple on screen with Clyde's dad, so that was really cool. Yeah, I am the less fun producer type, so I deal with schedules and budgets, but it's one of my favorite things is I love being around creative people, including my two friends here with us today. I love just being around creative energy and working to help creatively problem solve all of the problems that come up while making an animated show. And X-Men 97 has been an absolute highlight of my life. I started when I was 11 years old. I wanted to be an inker for comics and animation, and actually drew a picture of me working on Generation X comic.
It's amazing.
And my mother has that framed, and so some, you know, it's this wonderful thing.
This is cool.
Yeah.
Okay, our intro question today: when you open Daredevil number 110, there is a very busy ad page. You guys didn't see it because I didn't send it in the PDF. It is enormously busy. It's from the Olympic Sales Club, which is one of those places where back in the 70s you could go knock doors and sell greeting cards and then redeem points for different prizes. We're going to play a round of Fuck, Marry, Kill for each of you with prizes that were listed on this page that kids could redeem their postage cards for or for their points for. So Sean, Fuck, Marry, Kill, you have a poodle radio, an electric organ, or a Panasonic donut radio?
Oh man, I think you fucked the donut. That's probably makes the most sense. Probably kill the poodle and marry the organ. I was a music major before I got into animation and so forth. So if I was going to be married to anything, it would be something I could make music with.
Excellent. Let me welcome Emmy Yonemura to the show as well. Emmy, welcome to Gray Vulcan Lane.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. My name is Emmy, also Emmett, Yonemura, going through, you know, my own transition. So my pronouns are they, them, he. Let's see. I don't know. I've been in animation for about 10 years now. Started at Warner Brothers, and that was an amazing experience getting to work with my all-time favorite Batman. And then just continuing from there, I actually went to the Joe Kubert School. So I wanted to be in comics and kind of found really quickly that I prefer being amongst others. I can't, don't lock me in a room. I probably won't hit a deadline by myself. But if I have a team of people to encourage me, like Sean, and to give me a due date, that works a lot better for my brain. So yeah, I've always loved comics. I had a huge fascination with Japanese animation when I was a kid. It gave me a lot of pride being half Japanese and trying to kind of find a voice, you know, within my own community. So I think I really latched on to Japanese animation and to take some kind of like pride in it, but also just to be an extreme nerd. From there, that led me to Japanese comics. And then in high school, I had a lot of friends be like, you know, there's really cool American comics too, right? And so I think Preacher and Sandman were really my like gateway American comics. I think that's really where my heart lies. When more indie kind of Vertigo runs. From there, I've always loved animation. So it kind of made sense when I found this path. I think that this is like directing and working in animation is pretty much my dream job. It has enough technical to keep my brain. Like I love puzzles, but it also has enough art expression that I feel like I can express that. So
for today, do you prefer Emmy or Emmett?
You know, let's do Emmett if you don't mind. I would love that.
No, that sounds great.
I am in the middle of like transitioning. And I think that when someone transitions, it's also the world around you transitions. So I think that asking these questions and normalizing that it's okay to ask these questions is wonderful for people to hear. So
yeah, I work as a therapist in Salt Lake City, specializing in the trans community. So I watch people go through this journey on a daily basis. And I'm always just here to celebrate. I'm so happy that you're finding yourself wherever you land. Emmett, fuck, marry, kill. You have a U.S. regulation bugle, an umbrella tent, and a candle-making kit.
Oh, man.
The U.S. regulation is very important. If it was just any old bugle, that would be a different answer.
And that's where I feel like I would have to maybe fuck that one to really put in some, like, are you sure this is regulation? I'm gonna prove it not. And then, let's see, I got to kill that candle set. Because, like, I don't know. That just sounds a little too boring. It's got to go. I got to melt it all. I want to watch it burn. So then, I guess I'm...
Marry the umbrella tent?
Absolutely.
Excellent. It's so good to meet you. Let me also welcome the incredible Chase Conley to the show. Hi, Chase. Welcome to Gray Vulcan Lane.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Chase, episodic director on X-Men 97. It's kind of hard to jump in. Like, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. I've been doing art my entire life. So it's like, what do I just started age one? But no, I grew up reading comics. You know, I always tell the story. It's like when I was young, comics were on spinner racks everywhere. So you just had access to them wherever you went, be it the grocery store, the pharmacy, department stores, etc. And I grew up with my grandparents in like rural North Carolina when I was young. So my grandfather, when he would go to town, would let me buy a comic book. So I would ride with him all the time. And that happened to be X-Men at the time. So, you know, this is right around the time the Jim Lee run was going on. Speaking of the Kuberts, Adam Kubert was drawing a lot of Wolverine comics at the time. I still remember them vividly. So I had a lot of those issues during that run, which was really cool. I think Wolverine had just around that time lost his adamantium, you know, so that was cool. That was my introduction to illustration. And, you know, at the time, I think that that was like the highest form that you could find some of these concepts, you know, brought into a level of tangibility, right? Because movies weren't there. Video games weren't there yet. So I attached myself to comics and I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. And around the mid 90s, I discovered anime as well, which informed a lot of my sensibilities and taste. And that's kind of, I've always kind of been back and forth between those two worlds and tried to find a way to meld those things as far as my career goes. You know, Joe Madd was one of my heroes because he brought a lot of that sensibilities to the mainstream comic market. So that's really cool. And, you know, fast forward, I started working in comics. I pretty much knew what I wanted to do, you know, so as soon as I could sign a legal contract, I was working in comics, a lot of indie comics and stuff like that. But I think by the time I was 18, I didn't realize, I was like, I don't want to draw superheroes right now. You know, I wanted to draw other things and explore other stories, because that's all I had consumed growing up, along with anime, but I leaned more into that. And so I started working in as a comic book artist. And, you know, eventually it was like, I want to do something that challenges me artistically, but I don't want to jump back into superhero comics. Then animation was presented to me as an option. And I learned some of the jobs in the different departments in the industry. And a lot of my friends had made the pilgrimage to Los Angeles from all over the country, you know, deviant art cohorts, you know, back when that was like a big thing.
The Pencil Jack days.
Pencil Jack forums. I was in those forums, you know, Pencil Jack, Lead Heavy. There's a lot, you know, and Lead Heavy was cool because they had like a little classified section, I believe, too, where you can get some work and digital webbing, I'm thinking of as well. So, you know,
I published my first original comic book by finding an artist on digital webbing in 2000.
That was my first.
Yeah, yeah.
That was my first comic gig as well, which a writer reached out to me for 5 pages of a sample, you know, so they could, you know, try to hopefully get a publishing deal. So warm memories there. But yeah, no, I ended up switching to animation as a profession. I moved to LA about 13 years ago now. So I've been, I came out here and they couldn't get rid of me. So I've worked on a whole bunch of stuff since then.
It's so good to meet you and to just get to know some of the personalities behind the incredible art. I'm so happy you guys are here. Fuck, marry, kill, Chase. You get a folk tune wood guitar, a two-man boat, or an electric baseball game.
What? These are great.
I was gonna say these are cool options because, you know, these can go either way, you know.
Instead of pick the thing with a hole in it.
You gotta fuck the guitar because guitars are sexy.
Yes.
I'm gonna marry the boat because that's functional. Right? That's functional, right? You want function for longevity, right?
That's healthy.
And I'll kill the baseball kid. I've never played baseball like that. So
Sean, what is the moment you had when you realized, okay, this show is a hit? This is a big deal.
There was a moment really early on in just making the show, looking around on this team, looking at what Bo is putting together as like the story for that season arc, seeing what art. And just knowing for me as a fan, and I think for much of the crew as diehard fans, it's like, man, this is gonna hit. And then also being so confident in how proud we were of it that, like, I kind of didn't care if it was an actual quote unquote hit. You know, like for me, it was like, this works for me. This gives me what I have wanted for 30 years. I mean, really, it wasn't, because it's such a crapshoot, right? Like with what's gonna hit, with the type of fan bases that exist in the world of things. I mean, looking at what's like happening with Acolyte right now, like we don't have to talk about all that, but like we all have complaints and druthers and things like that. And I think there's very, very valid concerns with that show, but 13% on Rotten Tomatoes, like, I don't know if it's that bad, like, you know, and so knowing that it's like, hey, are people, and it was, I think that what I knew was there was a little bit of chirping that tried to start when the show first came out of like, oh, it's no good, no one's gonna like it, wokeism, blah blah blah, and that was immediately quashed by other fans like, nah man, like you're watching the wrong thing, like if you think this isn't good,
do you know X-Men at all?
Exactly. And I think that actually some of that quashing was happening within the fandom even before the show came out. And so there really wasn't that surge of, see, we were right, it was bad. It was immediately positive and supportive. And then it hit harder than I could have ever imagined. Like, I was really confident that the show would be good. I'm again, ridiculously confident in the talent on this team, top to bottom. I don't even like bottom in that, like from side to side, you know, because like there is no like bottom of the crew. Everybody kills it and everyone's important.
You hired both tops and bottoms, and we
exactly absolutely
tops, bottoms, middles,
air lob,
switchers, you know, yeah,
exactly, you know. And so I think that's sort of where it is, right? Like it hit harder than I ever anticipated. And then when I started getting random people who I haven't talked to in a decade or more, they're like, hey, I saw your name on this thing, it's so good, I love it. It's like, that means the world to me. Like, it's really cool.
I am 45 years old, and I had met several of the professionals, I'd interviewed some of the original voice actors when the show announcement came out. It took a couple years for everything to finally come out. It's like a Wednesday morning. I wake up at like 4 a.m. and I turn the volume on just loud enough so I can hear it, but not wake up the kids, right? make my coffee. I'm sitting there, and those opening notes of the intro hit. And by the end of the intro, I was crying. There was something about like nostalgia. Like, this is my childhood. This is the shit I escaped my shitty life with. You know, this incredible show, these characters, seeing it celebrated in the way that it was and done so beautifully and so carefully. I've been singing its praises ever since, but I don't watch anything twice, and I've watched every episode like 4 times. It's so good. My children love it. My husband loves it. Having conversations with them about oppression and resisting the urge to push pause and be like, that's Squid Boy. Let me tell you why he's important.
Yes. Well, that's Squid thing, Boy.
Squid. That's the thing too, Chad, is like, so I think that there's a hit, right? Where it's like, it's successfully reaching people commercially. But I think that the show is also just a success in what we wanted it to be. I've seen episode 5 as an example. I've seen that episode over 100 times in various formations, from script all the way through the finish. And I've really enjoyed watching, you know, reaction videos and reviews and things like that. And I find myself tearing up at all the same moments, no matter how many times I've seen it. And to me, that is how we know that we successfully made something that hits right. And that's really cool. And that, I think, is a credit to everything from the writing to then the directing that Emmett and Chase are, you know, responsible for. Emmett on 105 for that one, you know, and Jake overseeing all the way through, then like the voice acting and things like that. Rogue's voice, like what Lenore was able to do at the end of that. It's just, you, there's all of these markers that is just like, man, this works. Yeah. this is nice.
Chase, weaving this show together is not an easy feat. There's a thing that I noticed right away, and it took me a couple times of watching, which shows you how seamlessly it's done. There's so many different artists with different art styles working on this, but there's a through line. There's a way that all of these different scenes are, you have to look for the change in artists, even though it's apparent when you watch for it, but it weaves together so seamlessly that you can hardly tell there's different people working on it. How do you manage one single episode, let alone 10, when you're weaving this incredible team of passionate people together who have such vastly different styles and skill sets?
It's interesting when you are dealing with different people's sensibilities, because you want them to have ownership in their scenes. So you want them to bring the best version of them to you and to see if you can figure out a way to throw it into the pot, into the stew mix, and have it all taste great still. So the one thing that I like to do is have them pitch their best version of what they feel is the way they want to convey the scene. And then at the end of it, I just go back through and I'll do a pass on all of it. You know, so there's certain things that I do that I feel like are specific to me, but also hit the style of the show that we're trying to convey. You know, especially in terms of cinematic language, we just provide all of them with the references of like, these are our inspirations, right? So Emmett and I have a lot of the same kind of sensibilities as far as that goes. So we provide them with like, here's these movies that are staged in the way that we want to stage things, you know, so that way they kind of get a feel and hopefully are able to bring that in via osmosis, while also remaining true to what their own personal voice is. But really, it just comes down to, once we get all the storyboards in, if we're talking about just from strictly from script to storyboard, once we get the storyboards in, we just, as directors, we take our passes. And, you know, there's certain cinematography tricks that I like to see in my stuff. And there's certain kind of like live action staging I like to see in certain moments, especially with drama. Because if there's certain scenes in our show, if they were staged in live action and they were set up the exact same way, they would hit the same. Because I just think that you want the audience to forget they're watching a cartoon. You know, it's a medium, right? It's not a genre. So you just want to do that to create stakes. So for the me, show, that's my favorite part of directing, you know?
Yeah, the show also does, using my words, like a speed up, slow down kind of approach a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. There's so mm-hmm. much that happens all at once and so mm-hmm. quickly. And then you're almost left reeling with like, wait, did everything I need to happen there happen? I think it did. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it did. But then there's like, you know, suddenly Jubilee's in the Mojoverse for half an episode. And like, it feels like such a change of pace. But there's something perfect about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you want to make sure that the moments that are supposed to stick to your ribs, that there's time for that stuff to like really kind of like, you want to marinate in that for a moment. And it is tough when you have so many plot points happening at one time. So you just have to, you know, for us, in our first pass of the boards, a lot of times we give a lot of that stuff breath. And then we have to take a step back and look at the whole of it and be like, okay, what really needs to be slowed down so we get the pacing of this, so this absolutely hits emotionally? And then what else can we kind of expedite, you know, which is hard because it's like, you know, we always talk about, you know, kicking babies in the Sparta tunnel, you know, in the Sparta hole. It's kind of tough, but that's the
Or infecting babies with techno-organic viruses, you know.
Yeah, same thing, right? You know, but you know, fuck them kids, right? That's what we really
look. At least we're not Game of Thrones it.
That's really the approach, you know. you know, shout out to Mike. That's kind of what we do. We just take a step back and, you know, it's hard because really, if I pace the show out the way I wanted to, every episode would probably be about an hour and a half, right? Yes. But you just can't do that, you know? And also we want to try to make sure that we're still in the spirit.
I mean, I'm okay with it. Just
I would be too.
Can't afford it.
You got to holler at Sean. He's got the bread.
Yeah.
What's up, Sean?
I can't afford that. I mean, and along those lines too, like Chad, like about the idea of melding the styles together. Like, I think it is, it's a credit to the directors and to Jake to sort of be directing with a singular vision and matching the writing and story vision that was coming from Bo. But it's also like the artist adjusting a little. And then it's also a credit to the animation studio, because we'll have, you know, somewhere between 5 at fewest board artists working on any single episode, and at most somewhere like 10 to 12, depending on whether we had freelancers coming in, revisionists touching things, directors and their assistant directors boarding as well, both teams focused on a single episode because, you know, shit got real, you know, things like that. And it really comes down to the animation studios sort of melding and working with the directors and the show running aspect on our end to make that hit. And I'll be honest, one thing that has impressed me, like to your point, Chad, like is we switched studio in like for 2 of the episodes. 6 and 7 were animated by Tiger Animation and not Studio Mir. And there's really like, there was concern at first, like not at the talent of either of those studios, but there's always a concern when you're switching, because then like, can you tell? There are certain shows that you watch and you can tell, oh, episode 1, 3, and 5 were one studio and 2, 4, 6 were another, whatever. And I have not seen much of any commentary like along those lines. And that's a credit to both of those animation studios, both Mir and Tiger, for really establishing and sticking to the style that we and Marvel were establishing. You know, it's OG 90s sensibilities in these areas. It's awesome newer sensibilities in these areas, you know, and things like that. So there's a massive continuity effort just sort of across the board to try and overcome that possibility for the not just we quell the individuality, no one's, you know, but people bring their little flares to it, and then we sort of lean into stuff, you know, like we have certain board artists who kill certain types of moments, be they drama or be they action, and when they do that and we can point to that and say, hey, this is killer. Mm-hmm. Either they end up handling similar areas through other episodes to keep that continuity, or we point our professional artists and say, hey, you know, board this action a la Jalen, you know, board this, you know, drama, you know, a la whomever. Like it, and it really helps that way to have a team that respects one another and can sort of be slightly chameleon-esque in their adaptability within their style while still bringing their flavor to it.
Emmett, if you consider your personal contributions to the show, what is the scene you struggled most with as an artist? What's the scene you feel like you had the most influence over as an artist? And tell me one Easter egg you snuck in that you're really proud of.
Ooh, okay. Let's see, the struggle. I mean, you know, every episode has it, because we get wonderful scripts, but sometimes there's always something that doesn't necessarily translate visually, or we're looking at it and we're trying to break apart, like, what's the best way to sell this? I think episode 105 as a whole really was teamwork and team effort. It had a very strong script. I mean, it was a brilliant script, but there were still things in it that you needed to establish. Like, if we're going to destroy Genosha in the same episode where we introduce it, then we really need to spend time with it. You know, we have to give people something to mourn, because it's so easy to just destroy a big city it was actually quite fun really collaborating with Bo on that one to go, I think these are the beats that we really need to lean into. The Madeline cable scene was on the chopping block. And I just was like, yeah, absolutely no. Like, it's so vital. And I'm actually really proud that because we kept it, because I wanted it to conclude 103, you know, the Goblin Queen episode. It was like, it's her closure. We need that beat. That it ended up influencing the rest of the season to have more Cable and Summer's drama in it. I really liked that collaboration and kind of finding that voice with everybody in the team. But it was a lot of work. You know, I think we went through a lot of versions of 105 to really find, like, how is this going to hit the strongest? I think the final scene in it had multiple versions. Originally, Gambit wasn't fully dead yet. He was still there. So we kind of had like that, like, I'm walking to you, limping to you. And then so that we could have him die in Rogue's arms. But it just, we kept getting noted on it. It kept feeling like it was a double death. I agreed. And I think, you know, the most powerful thing we found was it. I sat with it one weekend and I just said, you know what it needs to be is he's just already dead and she's just crying over his body. And then showing that she's touching and then seeing her tear actually trailing over so that you knew that there was contact there. I mean, I think that to me just felt like such a home run. And it was, and it took multiple rounds to get to that. But I'm really proud.
I still remember when that was pitched, when, like, because Jake boarded that, like, when that was figured out. And, like, Jake's board of that, he built a little animatic of it. And he actually ended it on the, like, tinnitus ringtone, like, high pitched. Mm-hmm. Like, there was this visceral feelings.
That is a bold story for children.
It is.
You know, I made a documentary about a hate crime once, and I had to edit it about 1,000 times to get it right. So I know what that process is like on a different cutting room floor type of space. Like, what storylines do we give up? But that episode in particular, the building of the joy and the safety, the surprise of the threat. And then we get Gambit as the focal point and Rogue's grief as a way to channel our feelings. But there are multiple characters just casually, very quickly murdered. And you know that there are thousands more, as, like, it's just like a wash of energy and everyone's gone. And Gambit becomes the thing we're allowed to grieve when we don't even realize what else we're feeling. It's masterfully done. It's so, so good. The similar storyline emotionally was with Storm losing her powers. Between Allison Seeley Smith voicing that so perfectly and just the tremendous loss, God, I wept both times. After episode 5, I was done crying. I was just excited for the next one, but I stopped crying after 5. Did you have an Easter egg you were really proud of?
Ooh, okay. There's quite a few. I know that there's one that our storyboard supervisor, Chris Stepp, is really proud of and really shocked that no one has caught yet. In the original main titles, it got animated with Gambit's Ace of Spades upside down. The spade is upside down. So when we went to do the animation, we kept trying to be like, no, please, you got to get that upside down spade in there. And we actually got it delivered correctly. And we were like, no, we got to go in and we got to flip it upside down. So if you actually watch closely in the opening credits, it's still upside down. And that's just a nod to the original series.
Yeah, we boarded it upside down, and then Mir, God bless them, was like, oh, you messed this up, and they fixed it for us. And then we noted it, we're like, no, that's intentional. Thank you for catching and trying to fix, but, like, no, that was an intentional, because that's actually something we talked about early on, was, like, do we want to, because I don't know if, I mean, most diehard fans will know that, like, there's, in one of the episodes, there's a full-on shot of, like, Wolverine with, like, the cross, you know, do not use this panel barrier markers. And it's in the show. And so if you freeze at the right moment of the OG series, you can see, like, Wolverine, like, it's like a don't use this panel thing.
And we have one of those now. Apparently one of our retakes has Korean in it, and it aired, and it was one of their notes. And I'm like, honestly, because they're like, oh, we got to go in and fix that. And I'm like, please don't. It's kind of amazing. It's organic.
We had talked about trying to, like, do we build in moments like that to channel the OG, and, like, and it just became too much of a tightrope act to be like, how many intentional mistakes are a wonderful nerdy nod to the 90s show versus how many of them just make us look like we're incompetent in our jobs. Yeah. And so we're like, no, we'll just honor them in other ways with, like, really ridiculous melodramatic close-ups and saying each other's names a lot. And
Chase and then Sean, same question about Easter eggs. Is there one you're particularly proud of?
We have so many between, like, advertisements from, you know, just different companies that are in the Marvel universe, which is really cool to, just for the immersion. We did seed the adversary throughout, which I liked as well. You know, it was nice kind of foreshadowing, especially if anybody caught it. There's a couple times, you know, you can't, one is like with comp, you can barely see it, but there's a, we wanted to up the creepy factor. At one point there was a version of Forge's kitchen where everything in Forge's house was had an owl motif, but it's because it wasn't real. And so from like a dream catcher to bedposts to all of that stuff in 104, when you first see Storm and she's at the ranch, it's just like a sign to be like, oh, this is not right. Like, this is off. But I like the fact that we were able to put the owl in 102. So you can see it was already following her when she reaches for the sky. And she's like, you know, I can't feel anything anymore. As well as at the dinner table, like when she's sitting and she's eating porridge or the buffalo chili, my bad, the buffalo chili, and she leans back and the adversary is just creepily watching them in the rafters. You can barely see it. It's two little eyes. You know, that was the one that we preserved.
I didn't notice until I think my third time watching that Allison was also doing the voice of the adversary, and that took my breath. She did a brilliant job.
So good.
Yeah, just incredible. Sean, an Easter egg you're proud of?
I mean, I think that, you know, like for a classic Easter egg stuff, I live in Beast Lab. There's some books and so forth. You know, I think one is written by S. Strange, you know, for Stephen Strange, which is fun. I do think that there was also one that was meant to say just science, but was misspelled. And I can't remember if we actually fixed it or if we left it because it was funny to me.
We fixed it.
Okay, we fixed it. But eventually it was like science or
something. It was really amazing. I was like, the smartest book is also the dumbest book on the show.
The original Latin spelling of science. And then sort of non, like traditional Easter egg and more like nerdy self-serving Easter eggs is there's a number of crew members who are in the episodes. One of our awesome background painters, Ryan, and his dog are the guy and the dog who are almost hit by Wolverine driving the Jeep up on the sidewalk. I was randomly drawn as the cameraman with Trish Tilby, and I was unaware when that was happening that he was then also going to become a Prime. And then once I knew that he was a Prime and was going to be in 108, I went to Chase and his team and was like, hey, I'm going to need to get my ass kicked by Nightcrawler. Like, so that was the one request that I made. I was like, I never asked to be a character. I didn't ask to be made a Prime. But once all of those factors had been a thing and I realized that Trish was there, I was like, if Trish is at the mansion, then my guy's at the mansion. So therefore, like in this fight, this person who gets kicked by Nightcrawler, that's all I wanted. I wanted one kick from Nightcrawler. I ended up getting like my head cut off by Nightcrawler and like stabbed and bammed by him.
But you put it back on, though.
Nightcrawler fans. It was a dream come true.
And I totally have another one that I think is super subtle because it's not really in the X-Men zeitgeist. So in 105, we actually created a new character who we've lovingly named Parrot. She's one of the kids because we got actually an order for inclusion and to have handicapable inclusion in our show. We developed this character who she can transform into a bird. So hence the name Parrot, because I love that mutant names can be so simple. And she actually has one of her legs is gone, and she has a prosthetic. And what I thought was kind of fun is because she transforms, okay, yeah, she can transform with her clothes because that's easier for everybody. But when she's a bird form, Leech carries a backpack with her leg in it for her so that when she de-transforms, Leech can be like, here you go. Because I imagine Leech would be like, even though it's Leech, he would still be the best support character if you had like a D&D game going. Like he would just really want to help even if he's the one taking all your powers away. So I don't know. That's just like a real subtle thing that I think people didn't quite pick up on because Parrot's just not a character people were looking for. But I loved that relationship between them and to kind of give them that like unwritten story that in this group of friends, this is how organic and how well they all work together. Also so that then they would all be very sad when Leech was gone.
But with Parrot, I have definitely seen some love on the internet for like, hey, who's that character? Everyone's trying to source, like, is that a character that exists? Is that new? I think Bo had confirmed on Twitter there was a new character at one point in time, but like, you know, getting her name out there is really cool. I also do think that there's one, I can't honestly remember if this was an intentional Easter egg or if this is something that is almost a mirror thing. But there is, at the beginning of 105, there is a couple character who are standing holding hands, two women. And then at the end of the episode, one of them is sort of seen mourning at a grave, but she's wearing the clothes of the other one.
Like the bandana that they had.
Yeah, she has the bandana around. And so it's one of those things that like just in like you get these like background stories happening. And I was pretty sure that we had done that intentionally.
I think that was our design team. Yeah. I think so Frank Moran is our character. He's he helps our character design team on the production side. So he'll help like if we just need extras but we don't know who they are necessarily. Frank is a super fan and he has like this encyclopedia in his head, and I'll be like, I need someone like this, this, and this. Who do you have? And he will find them, he will get them approved by Marvel so that we can use them. And they always fit perfectly. But I think when he was calling out them, he managed to do that story in there by simply just calling them out and then doing just a quick character change on the one so that she could be wearing her girlfriend's bandana. And I love that so much. And that's what I mean, that the whole crew is a fan. Yeah. I love that.
Frank is so good at what he does. He not only knows the characters, he knows a lot of the different costume variations and so forth. And so even if you're thinking like, oh, did she wear something with like a yellow stripe, he's like, oh yeah, that was in the 85 run of
I've got it here on my phone. Yeah, I'm that guy. Chase, there are some key moments in the show that reflect the power of the changing times, and these stories being told now resonate in a different way than they would have then. Two of them that really stand out in my brain that hit me just hard, and again, open tears both times. The show opens with a group of white bigoted men with guns holding a teenage boy of color in a chair, and the first two people to come to the rescue are the two black superheroes. And there's something so profound about that's the way the show is opening. The second one that was so enormous for me, and the whole episode, and I would say my favorite episode of the whole season is episode 2, if I'm honest. The way the trial of Magneto ends with Magnus carrying those judges into the sky, and they're like, wait, we didn't do anything wrong? And he's like, yeah, you reasoned with us, and now they're going to blame you too. Talk to me about some of those conversations about the resonance that was shown. People may not even realize it as they're watching, but those messages hit home hard in 2024.
Yeah, I think that from the beginning, Bo was really on top of just trying to highlight some of the other characters on our team, especially a lot of the characters of color. That for sure was baked into a lot of our scripts already. So, when we got into these scenes, it was just kind of easy to highlight that. One of my personal favorite moments is the Magneto lift sequence. Like, that was just great. It was the first sequence I boarded for the show. I didn't board it all by myself. Like, I boarded a lot of it leading up to it. And then Marvin Britt, amazing board artist, he boarded the actual lift into space. And then I went back through and tweaked some of the staging and some of the acting. But it was just such a poignant moment for me, and it felt like these were being able to showcase that coupled with like the cinematic staging that Emmett and I were talking about that we loved, especially having a team of storyboard artists that felt the same way. It was just really cool to be able to see that pulled into like a more contemporary model, so to speak, so that was really dope. And for me, it can easily become the Jean and Cyclops show, and so it was nice to be able to highlight Bishop. I've always loved Bishop a lot, and I've always kind of felt like in the comics they didn't do him much justice, and I guess that's subjective, right? I think in more recent years they've done their best to trying to highlight more about his story, but it was cool just to see him right off the rip, like, a fan favorite. The first thing you see Bishop, so it was important, I feel like, as well, to a lot of black fans that felt like, we don't have, there's not many superheroes that we have that they highlight all the time. So
I had notes of protest in it for me, which was important to see right at the start. Those bigoted Friends of Humanity with their stupid hats and vests, punch them in the face. It's such a good way to open. Emmett, was there a particular moment on the show where you thought they are not going to let us get away with this? There's a lot of moments on the show that surprised me. Jean saying, I'm not sure I want my child to be a mutant, voicing that. Morph saying, I love you to Wolverine. Leech being murdered when he's the helpless one with the promise made to him. There's a lot of key moments there. Was there one that stood out to you as they're never going to let us get away with this?
I feel like there were many, because we really weren't sure what was going to be happening. I feel like even though we knew this was going to be a TV-14 show, it still felt like there was always going to be concern of, is this too heavy? So I do think it was 105 when we were first pitching our animatics and what the board artists had done of just like, are you guys sure you want a full on massacre? And like, I know that it's important to tell this. It's very important, especially today. But we work for Disney, who do like to sometimes sugarcoat things. And I just wasn't sure that we were going to allow it to be as honestly brutal as it really was. I think there were even concerns because of everything that's going on in Gaza right now. I wasn't sure if that was going to have an effect on our show as well.
Well, and I think too, you know, obviously, yeah, 105 from the last 10 minutes, it was always very like, are we okay here? From script, animatics, board, you know, like every stage is like, are they gonna? But for me also, you know, in 9 with the Fatal Attractions moment, mm-hmm. Are they gonna let us shank Magneto, you know, fully? And we're also like, I think, you know, we did have to outline very kind of specific rules of how we dealt with those things. And so there's
Wolverine's claws going through Magneto's insane.
Yes.
Yeah. There were several blood packs.
But there's not a lot of, like spurting blood. This is not Kill Bill, yeah. You know, with all of the blood spray and things like that. So, and ultimately, you know, we do have some animation studios and friends working on the show in Korea who would love to do the powerhouse animation and go the route of Castlevania or Blood of Zeus, and some of which Chase worked on, you know, and have some of those more like violent moments. And we definitely did have to pull back, but we did have to figure out like, what is that balance? Like, how much blood can be on Wolverine's claws to make it impactful? Like, I remember sitting on the couch watching the episode with my family, you know, I'm concerned there. And my wife audibly gasps when you see the claws coming through, you know, Magneto's chest, and just sort of looks over at me. And I'm like, you know,
but you knew.
Well, and even watching with my family and so forth, that was a moment that I knew was gonna be a thing. And so that's what sort of knew when I was gonna question, is Disney gonna let us do this? But still, it is 105, because I remember about halfway through 105, I'm sitting and watching, and my two children, 7 and 8, my two younger ones, the eight-year-old's like, oh, I really like Leech. Immediately followed by my son going, my favorite's Gambit. And me going, oh, fuck. This is not going to end well.
I know. I'm just like, honestly, this makes me so happy. Crying children.
My because daughter sobbed. Always,
fuck them kids, but not your kids, yeah. Though.
my daughter sobbed for 45 minutes and then drew a little RIP Gambit tombstone that she brought out to me, and then proceeded to tell me that she was gonna wear black every Wednesday until we brought Gambit back.
And I was like, gonna be a while.
I can't promise you. Like I said, I can't promise you that's gonna, I don't control that.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed Tom Brevoort, who's the new head editor over the X-Men comics, and I asked for his opinion on X-Men 97. He basically, and I'm using my summary here, he said it was so good that it's making my job harder because the show's so top quality that I can't produce an okay X-Men product now. Like, it has to be top line. As we are approaching X-Men season 2, and I know you guys are in active production at various levels, how does the pressure of 100% on Rotten Tomatoes feel?
It's a lot.
I'll say, yeah, I mean, it is a lot, but I don't think it stops us from, you know, what our process is, because we just make the show we want to see. I just make the show. I feel like we, you know, we have good taste. I just want to make the show that I would like to watch. And that's always kind of just been my guiding light as far as like a mentality as when approaching any project. And then you kind of, you know, the studio can throttle you and be like, well, this is not what we want. But I think that now after the season 1 and we've kind of all figured out like what our tastes are, you know, it's not so crazy. At least that's not the way I go into it, you know. But you know, anything you make, you don't want it to be hated, you know, for sure.
Jubilee's dance scene to Gambit's motorcycle ride to, I mean, you guys just brilliant, brilliant job. It's just top quality. I mean, you know, but it's great. And I'm so happy that we are living in an age where this is coming out and I get to share it with my kiddos. And I agree, fuck them kids, but not mine.
Yeah, exactly.
God. I went to the mall the other day. There's a man with like a 4-year-old daughter at the mall wearing a shirt that had so many words on it. And I paused and looked at his shirt. He's holding hands with his kid. And it says, yes, I have a daughter. I also have a handgun, a shovel, a backyard, and an alibi. And I was like, what in the hell are you wearing? It's the worst shirt I've ever seen. That was a huge tangent. My
Jeez. Yeah, no, it's okay. I mean, at least he's telling you up front, you know, like, yeah, my daughter will forever be single.
I'm going to murder you if you look at my child, or maybe he's just going to murder his child. I'm not sure.
I thought he was threatening to, murder his child. And I'm like, can this be used in the court of law as proof?
You're supposed to wait until your daughter is like of dating age to wear
them. Sure. That's what makes it
strict. Because then it makes it clear that, like, yeah, I have a teenage daughter. And if you hurt her, because I mean, as the father of daughters, like, there's definitely, I mean, actually, the father of kids, you hurt my son, I'll kill you too. Like, but, but there is that, like, mentality of, like, don't you hurt him. Like,
Yeah.
I understand, but I'm not going to advertise that. Like, plus there's evidence that I...
Okay, we're going to transition to our issue review in this moment.
Okay.
We're going to be reviewing Daredevil number 110.
Get 15% off a set of BrakeBest Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Let me give just a little bit of a setup. This is the fifth installment of the 7-part Black Spectre story that Steve Gerber built in the early 70s. Shanna the She-Devil was one of the 3 titles Marvel launched that was for women by women. None of them succeeded past more than a couple of issues. We had Night Nurse, the Cat, and Shanna the She-Devil. By issue 5, Steve Gerber had completely taken over the writing of Shanna. Shanna is a white character based in Africa, where her father is a diamond miner, and she's living with her leopard cats. She's a heroic character. She's a second wave feminist character. She's got that kind of Linda Carter Wonder Woman energy about her, in that she's tough and she'll beat you in arm wrestling, you know. But the story, so issues 4 and 5 introduced first the Mandrill, and then Necra. Mandrill is introduced as a character who's trying to conquer African nations. He has a literal monkey face. He's arrested at the end of the issue, but he has an army of black women who are working for him, who he has tattooed his monkey face onto their faces. In issue number 5, we meet Necra, who is the high priestess of his cult of hate. Her introduction is stunning. It's actually really magical. It gives me very like Blackula energy. It's very like 1970s like voodoo horror blaxploitation film energy. And then the book was canceled. So it's now a couple years later, Steve Gerber is writing Daredevil, and he brings these characters back and retitles the terrorist group Black Spectre, which is a rough thing already. But in this issue, we're going to learn that Black Spectre are this army of African women who have been tattooed. And we also learn for the first time that Mandrill has powers of pheromones. He can control women. We also learn that he is a white man born to look like a monkey, who now has an army of black women. We're going to talk all about it today. It's a crazy, crazy, crazy story. Now, Steve Gerber was an absurdist. This is the guy who created Howard the Duck. If we're being generous, this seems to be his story of as a white man saying, like, look, race is ridiculous. And let's talk about why. Here we have a black white baby and a white black baby. And look at how silly it all is. Almost seems to be the point he's making, but it's done in a really harsh, horrible way. And he has some other stories that kind of match this tone. So we're not excusing that. He's not around anymore, but it's a rough story, even though there's still a lot of magic in it. So to recap very quickly, Black Spectre has been trying to take over America by sowing discord in all kinds of ways. There are agents wearing chonky green and yellow. The name Black Spectre is already rough. They shot Foggy Nelson, the district attorney. They stole some printing plates. They defaced American monuments with black draping and swastikas. And they even carved Adolf Hitler's face into Mount Rushmore with lasers. So this is a crazy, crazy set of stories. We've gotten through this much. Daredevil and the Thing have been fighting them. And Necra has captured the Black Widow, who now seems to be working for the Mandrill. That's the very quick setup to this story. Birthright is the title. This was published in June 1974 by Steve Gerber and one of my favorite artists of all time, Gene Colan. The inks are by Frank Chiaramonte. Linda Lessman is the letterer. Linda Lessman is on colors. Artie Simek on letters. Roy Thomas is the editor. Before we jump into the story specific points, I would love to hear from each of you what it was like to pick up this very random 1974 comic with very little context provided. Did you enjoy your read of Daredevil 110?
As far as like reading the classic material, just from a purely like aesthetic standpoint, it's super enjoyable. I just think that a lot of artists from that era, I feel like they were more fundamentally sound. That is not a shot to a lot of artists of contemporary work, but I like that work a lot. It grounds it a lot, especially whenever you're reading some of this stuff. It almost feels like, you know, old like Frank Frazetta comics, you know, so it fits like that Edgar Rice Burroughs-ish kind of vibe, you know. But I just love the artwork. I think it's amazing. You know, it's really dope. It's great storytelling as well. I love the design sensibilities. I love the paneling and everything. It fits the pacing, at least in the way that they write, which is just, you know, Emmett and I have always talked about this, like, you know, the artists just go in and draw cool panels and then the writers come in and make some shit up and throw it in those panels a lot of times. So from that, it's enjoyable. It's a time machine. And
Emmett?
It was a little bit of a challenge to get through. I totally agree. I was really enjoying the art. It kind of also gave me like Neil Adams vibes. I mean, just looking at the anatomy, it just looked like, somebody was having fun drawing this, especially when Daredevil's like flipping off of like the hover vehicle. And it did, though. It did give me a lot of strong vibes of that this was done the Marvel way, which people have talked about in the comics industry, where it's done where you might have an outline, but you let the artist go, and then the writer afterwards kind of comes in and then fills in more dialogue, which is cool. But I definitely got the vibes off of that for this, because it almost felt like sometimes the dialogue was commentary on what you were seeing in the art. And I mean, even to the point where they're doing the classic, here's a note from the editor to explain this. So I loved it for almost that nostalgia. It did was definitely like, oh yes, I'm definitely reading a Marvel comic. This is fun. But yeah, that storyline sure is interesting. I think I knew I was definitely in for some pain as soon as the backstory starts on page 13. What they do immediately is they say, so this white guy was a scientist and this black woman was the cleaner. Yep. And I was like, so
I got bullet points. That's one.
Oh, yeah. But like, that's where I just immediately knew. I was like, oh, God, here we go. Like, God forbid she be the scientist or just another scientist there. No, she's the cleaning lady. Like, thanks. Like, I already saw like whatever mission this guy had that he was trying to make commentary on race is already just not going well.
The other story that he's really famous for in this category, and there's a few others, of course, and Steve Gerber, of course, has some great stories too. His man is amazing. But there's a storyline in The Defenders where there's a group called the Sons of the Serpent, who are white supremacists attacking black people. The revelation at the end is that their leader is a black man who's trying to profit off of racism. And you're just like, no, 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 no. Like, it makes you so angry. He has a couple of these stories where he just seems to try to be flipping things on its head. This story is running contemporarily to what we'll be covering on my show in August, which is the infamous Richard Nixon is a member of the KKK, like secret empire in the Marvel Universe. He tries to kidnap mutants, take over the country, and in the end kills himself in front of Captain America, who quits being Captain America afterward. Like, there's some crazy edgy stories happening during this era. Sean, what was it like for you to open this book?
Man, so I'm gonna preface it by saying, like, I'm not an artist. I wanted to be an inker when I was 11, and then it stopped. So, I definitely look at things through different lens. I will also preface this by saying I'm pretty easily entertained in the overall, and usually things for me fall in the category of like, I was entertained by that, or I wasn't. But I also, like, I really did like the art. Like, as someone who has not studied art, who is not, you know, just seeing the poses and the forms, especially on Daredevil, it's very like, ooh, Daredevil pretty.
Just
the lines of him, like, you know, Emmett, you highlight when he's flying through the air and things like that. But I was also, I was interested enough in what happened here that, like, and me being someone who loves story overall, like, I did then go back and, like, so I read issue 109 and I read the Marvel 2 and 1 number 3, and then I, you know, read 111 after it, so I sort of knew, you know, would know what happened before and after it. And I will say, to add to the absurdist things that happened you know, before this issue, I think my favorite was that Mandrill and his army or whatever, they hypnotized some actors who were in a play that Matt Murdock went to see with Foggy's sister. That's fun. And
but some of the most openly racist shit in that play that I've ever seen in a comic book, like horrible. Yeah.
Well, Captain America comes out and starts an actor Captain America comes out and starts beating up a black guy on stage, but it's legit. Like Matt Murdock can tell, like, oh, he's actually beating him up. He's actually hurting him. And then an actor dressed as Hitler comes out and shoots Captain America and kills him on stage in front of people because he's hypnotized, and then blows his own brains out.
Yeah, so the Mandrill can control your mind. That's what's happening. But I will say this, and then we don't have to keep talking about this part of it. We're really careful on this show to like not assume intent of someone, but it's hard to call this story anything but openly racist. We could also say Steve Gerber was very talented, but there are some major, major problems. The title Black Spectre alone is too much. Like it's too much. So we're going to review the opening part of this relatively quickly, and then I want to focus the bulk of our conversation on the Necromandrill stuff. These are the X-Men characters anyway that we're here for. The cover is Daredevil versus some, Black Spectre agents who have the wonkiest, terrible, like, weirdest costumes. They're these chunky green suits with, like, hazmat helmets and, like, tubes. It's a very strange thing. The Spectre of the Master is also hanging in the background. And notice that they use the word Master, the white monkey man who's controlling the army of black women against their will. Very rough. At the end of Marvel 2 and 1 number 3, the Thing walks out and sees the Mandrill unmask, and it's one of the funniest images in all of comic book history. He has these beady blue eyes. We talked about it in the previous episode, but it's hilarious. So we open here on Daredevil and Thing in the Fantasticar. Thing is describing, like, I don't know what happened. Like, he got his mind taken over. But I saw that thing, and it was ugly. He goes, the only time I've ever seen anything uglier is when I look in a mirror. Daredevil jumps out of the ship and is, like, really thinking things through. And two agents of Black Spectre are waiting. It turns out they are plants sent by the Mandrill to kind of lure him in. He immediately recognizes that. He's kicking their asses. And he thinks again, like, these do not feel like big men. These feel like different. Because they don't weigh enough and their heartbeats are weak. He unmasks one and realizes it's a woman underneath, but this man is blind. He cannot see her skin color nor the tattoos of the monkey on her face. And that's the first really jarring moment in this particular issue, is that tattoo, because you probably haven't read Shanna at this point. That was a few years ago. Any thoughts on the introductory fight and that kind of revelation of this poor woman in the arbor?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot. I mean, it's all very thinly veiled, you know, that's the thing. It's so thinly veiled that it's hard for me to not assume things, you know, intent, as we said.
Yeah, it's all right to call this story racist.
I did laugh. I was like, oh, so he just backhanded her to sleep. You know, that was kind of funny, but not in a, anyway. But yeah.
Not in a sexy way? Okay.
No, not at all. But when I saw that, I was like, I know this is not a black woman with a monkey tattoo on her face. Like, that was just the first thing that I thought, you know? So, yeah, that's as far as I got with that point. At that point, you know, I was just like, this is already wild. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, we chose some crazy comics to go through, guys. And I apologize personally if this was an unpleasant journey for any of you.
it's actually so absurd. I mean, I've read a lot of I've watched a lot of blaxploitation stuff, and I mean, I worked on Black Dynamite. We made fun of a lot of this stuff. You know, we've had crazy episodes ourselves. You know, as far as, like, you know, also Nixon being a wild racist in control of things that harm the black community. And we had an episode called Honky Kong, you know what I mean? Which was a white version of King Kong that kidnapped a black woman. You know what I mean? So we did a lot of crazy stuff, you know, but so I was entertained, to Sean's point. Like, I was just like, okay, this is wild. But it was just how insane it is to me that this was okay.
It's so blatant. Yeah. Daredevil rushes to the police station. The Black Spectre agents were captured, are put in jail. Shanna the She-Devil comes in wearing... Emmett, do you want to describe Shanna's outfit in this panel? She's got both her leopards on a leash. This is her Real Housewives entry.
I honestly just didn't understand her. I didn't get it. And all I really honestly see is Elon Musk in a dress. So, like, because I just I'm like, why is this the representation? Why? I don't understand any of this. So I was honestly just already kind of mind blown and taken out of it.
By the way, all of the black women in Mandrill's army are there, but Shanna is the one woman who could resist his control. The white woman got to resist. It's rough.
The only one. It's like, you know, Kazar and her have always been problematic for me, just like Tarzan. It's that same thing where I don't understand. It's like the white person can conquer the jungle. Well, first off, that shit's just ridiculous.
We have had some Kazar conversations on this show.
Yeah, I fucking hate the character. I've never liked the character because I know where it stems from. And I know they try to make the excuse of like, oh, it's the savage land and he was exploring. I know the whole backstory, both of the characters. But, and then it's also just like, yeah, the she-devil from Africa is this... It's wild, you know, so yeah. it goes back into the Tarzan trope of just, you know, white people being the masters of Africa. You know, I've always just had an issue with that. And it's laughable at best. But, you know, even with the jungle cats, right, it's just showing that I have conquered this. It's crazy. It's crazy.
We've talked about this month on the show already, but she raised these two cats from birth after their mother got killed in her arms. And then she skinned the mother and turned the skin into her fur bikini that she wears as her costume. So that's something that we talked about earlier this month on the show.
Wow. So I officially hate her. Yeah, I hate her. Like, cool. Way to make me hate a character fast. Like,
and super random side point that doesn't have to do with like this aspect of it. I'm reading and they're like, the cops are telling Daredevil, we can't hold these women. Like, they didn't do anything wrong. And he's like, not even disturbing the peace. I was like, they just assaulted you. Like, they attacked you in an alley. Like, what do you mean they no charges? Just interesting that way. Just like the comic logic. I think that then, you know, does sort of fit into the Marvel process of it, of like, well, we sort of drew ourselves into a corner, or wrote ourselves into a corner based on the drawings, and now we need to let him go.
Yeah. So and then the revelation. I'm sorry.
Please.
I was going to say, and then the revelation of what happens, it makes it even more insane to me, where I was just like, I know they didn't. I just kept asking myself, I was like, wait, that didn't happen. It's like, so you got black women with monkey tattoos on their face, and then you suicide bombed them. That's crazy.
So from miles away, Black Spectre, under the command of Necra, they turn a dial, right, and those women who were captured by the police self-destruct. They blow up, which is horrible. And Necra basically is saying, excellent, we've shown them we shall go to any length to protect our sacred cause. A pity those two had to be sacrificed. And yet it was well worth it if Daredevil is a man without fear no more. In my mind, Necra sounds like Eartha Kitt, but I can't quite do
her voice. I'm loving it.
I'm sure.
The Black Widow is being held hostage. Again, she is being mind controlled. And then they go back into, quote, the leader's den. There is we saw this in earlier issues. It's a giant Mandrill statue that Mandrill had made with a flaming brazier coming from its crotch, where you can go dance up there. Like, Necra likes to dance up there and scream about hate while all the women bow for her and chant hate back and forth in between them. Necra's power is to grow stronger from her hate. They find the Mandrill standing inside. They're in some weird building in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. He's wearing full black robes. It's basically the KKK, except it's a horned mask and like it's black robes with the weirdest belt I've ever seen. Just this giant fucking golden diamond on a red like sash. He wants you looking at his crotch. Terrible, terrible character, this man. His power is rape. It's awful. He gives me like Purple Man vibes, if you guys have seen Jessica Jones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Somehow he's worse than the Purple Man. Greetings, Necra, Black Widow. May I construe from your smile, priestess, that our suicide mission has been carried out as I ordered. He's just awful. And he wants to recruit Daredevil as a potential ally for some reason. He's gathering power. We don't know exactly what's going on. So he flies out in his personal airship to go find Daredevil, who's still with Shanna the She-Devil, before he hops off on his own and he's swinging through the city thinking about his crazy life.
I wasn't familiar with Necra until this comic, you know, like, of course, I had some knowledge of Kazar and Shanna the She-Devil. But the first thing I noticed was the crotch on fire. But then when I got later into the comic and what I felt like it was allegory for, you know, and just in terms of his pheromones and all that stuff, it was felt like, you know, we'll get into it later. But just to set it up, it's like just felt more like women's uncontrollable lust for the black male body. Right. That's what it felt like. You know, it's just like this this fantasy, you know, that he was speaking to, that even that they went back to, like, in the Jim Crow era, you know, just and talked about just about like how sexually aggressive Black men could have been and stuff like that. And that's exactly what it felt like to me, where it's just like, oh yeah, you know, women can't contain themselves around this. And mm-hmm. It just felt thinly veiled. And
like Steve Gerber has for sure seen the Birth of a Nation, like
100%, right? 100%. And then I didn't know that until I saw the backstory, and I was like, wait a minute, I have so many questions about Necra, because I was like, wait a minute. So wait, is she, well, we'll get to that later. Well, I'll ask that question whenever we get to it. But I thought that was hilarious. And it's just the flaming crotch of it all, where I was just like, you know, this guy's just, you know.
My only notes for page 9 just say monkey loins. Like, that's the only, it's just the, you know, and that's because you've got the statue and you've got his belt, which symbolizes the statue flame. In that same way. There's just like flaming loins. It does beg the question, though, that knowing from the previous, or no, it's not the previous, it's the issue after this, where you find out about Shan the She-Devil's ability to resist, you know, as the white woman, whatever, but Natasha can't? Like, Black Widow is...
I mean, well, she's a commie, Russians, so.
Yeah, Russians are inferior to regular white people, and so therefore, like, that's just an interesting... And I don't know if it subverts, like, the, you know, the, like, we're talking about that there is the... that idea of like, oh, the Black male form and lust and things like that, when it's then revealed like he's not actually even a Black man.
Yeah, I mentioned this on the show before, and we'll get into it. And this is unfortunate to take the conversation here because it's heavy, but just to note very quickly, we have a country that is founded on a white man's ability to do whatever he wants to a Black woman's body, but then creating entire legislation around what a Black man is not able to do to a white woman's body. Right. And this story is just that at a very unfortunate level. It's very, very uncomfortable. Moving forward with the next couple of story points very quickly. And by the way, Chase, the episode coming out immediately after this is going to be kind of an academic discussion about Necra's entire history. So if you want to learn more about this character, she's actually pretty magical, and she's been reclaimed in recent years and like done beautifully in the comics in the last 10 years or so. But there's also an episode of Cerebro by Connor Goldsmith about Necra with Jordan Bloom that'll make you laugh your ass off, that talks all about this stuff too. It's really great.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Yeah, it's good. She's a fantastic character. And Victor Laval has been working a lot with this character in the last several years of comics. It's been really good. So Daredevil gets home. Mandrill is inside in his robes with some armed agents. It is only I, the leader of Black Spectre. And they're holding Daredevil at gunpoint. He wants to recruit Daredevil, but he also knows Daredevil's secret identity because he made Black Widow tell him. He rips off his mask and we got the giant monkey face. And I'm sure this was like a what the fuck moment for at least all of you.
It did not for me. It felt weirdly familiar because the main villain of Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beast is a mutant. A Mandrill named Scarlemagne. It's exactly the same character, like, you know what I mean, who controls himself off pheromones and stuff, like controls people around him off of pheromones and stuff. So I thought that was like, oh, okay, we're doing Scarlemagne.
And even even crazier part, this is a white man who looks like a monkey, but his first name is Jerome, which is
insane. Wait a minute, is Jerome, like, you know, this is the thing that I also saw, you know, it's like Jerome and Tyrone. Tyrone is an Irish name, but they always assign it to Black people. It's not even, I don't know how that happened at one point. And I wouldn't be surprised if Jerome is as well, you know, so.
Emmett, were you surprised to see the Monkey Man?
A little, but I kind of was expecting it was coming. And it was, it's one of those things where I just don't know where his mandible goes when he's wearing a hood. Like, I don't, none of this logic tracks, but I love it. I wish I had magical clothes that could make me disappear 15 pounds, but okay. As a science nerd, do love that baboons are monkeys, so all the terminology works, because otherwise I'd be like, well, actually, but yeah, no.
White monkey man with a flaming statue crotch, whose name is the Mandrill, right? Also, like, if you put the hyphen in there and it changes everything.
and also, I thought his statue was a wolf man, so I kind of got confused there. And also how it's a perfect representation, apparently, of African jungle, like, sure.
So I'm gonna read a couple pages of dialogue here very quickly, because this is the meat of the story that we really need to talk about when it comes to mutants. Mandrill describes himself as, all women love me, I am their master, I am Mandrill, And they're having a little conversation, a little back and forth. Daredevil's like, holy shit, that's not a mask. And Mandrill decides to share his origin story. I am a mutant, Daredevil, a victim of America's insane lust to progress technologically without consideration for the human factor. More, I am the engineer of the boldest effort in the history of man to change the world. Lest you think me mad, Murdoch, allow me to relate to you my story, a tale which began in New Mexico in 1944 at the site of one of America's earliest atomic research facilities. It was late, past normal work hours, only two persons were present, a white man, a scientist, and a black woman, a cleaning lady. Fuck. Both were going about their work, oblivious to the rumbling noises from deep in the earth beneath them, from the primitive nuclear pile. It exploded. Not an atomic blast, some fault in the electrical system. It turned out so both persons lived through it, but they absorbed massive doses of radiation from the exposed pile itself, more than enough to alter the structure of their genes. Of course, little was known in those days of the havoc radiation could wreak upon those transmitters of hereditary characteristics. And so it came as quite as a surprise to the scientist and his Caucasian wife, again, skin color mention, when 1 year after the accident, their son was born with black skin and tufts of hair sprouting from his tiny body. Equally distressed were the black woman and her black husband when another year later, their daughter was born with chalk white skin and fearsome vampire-like fangs. And this is the cutest fucking vampire baby I've ever seen. These two infants were myself, of course, and my priestess Necra. We were perhaps the first American victims of radioactive mutation, and as such, we were different. In America, that alone is just cause for others to hate you. My childhood was sheer torment. By the time I had reached school age, my features had begun to mutate further toward their present state. As for Necra, her white skin made her a pariah, an object of scorn among her race also. A black-white boy and a white-black girl, both ostracized, both learning the same ugly lesson about America. Whew. Okay. We're getting through it, I promise. I'll go quick here. At 10, I suffered the ultimate blow. My parents could no longer bear the burden my presence placed upon them, so my father drove me out to the desert one day and left me there to die. I hated him for that, but I didn't blame him. Why should he have to suffer for what I was? Still, I determined then and there to kill him, to trek back across those arid sands and crush him with the terrible strength the radiation had imbued in me. Strength I'd had to conceal for fear of being branded as more than a freak, a monster. That strength and my uncanny endurance saved me. I made the impossible journey, but I never went back to that hateful town. For scant miles from my parents' home, a fateful meeting occurred. She was running away from the same hatred that had plagued me. She offered me water and the first honest empathy I'd ever known, and we became partners on the spot. Our goal to keep forever on the move, to protect one another and shun all human companionship. We would be wanderers and live by our wits and stealth. We educated ourselves by listening to lessons from outside school walls and reading stolen books. And I went on that town until one night outside a tiny Missouri town, some 6 years after our first meeting, what we had always dreaded finally came to pass. We'd been discovered. And we see a group of white men with guns and pitchforks offer to kill them. They are speaking in bad drawls. And Mandrill yells, "You're the monsters, not us. Your faces twisted with hate are uglier even than ours ever could be." And Necra says, "We hate you. I was certain Necra had gone mad. Neither of us knew what was truly going on with her. Hate, 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 hate. But we soon learned soon enough when one of our attackers stabbed savagely at her with a steel pitchfork. We were stunned as he was at the result, and the pitchfork is bent. But there was no time to ponder, not with our very survival at stake. For the first time, we unleashed our own seething hatred, hatred locked within us all those years, and we used it to kill. Just as they employed their most potent weapons in an effort to destroy us, however, we succeeded where they failed. Necra could become virtually invulnerable. We reasoned later, if she could work up sufficient hate, that emotion released her mutant power, and suddenly we were helpless no longer. In the time it took to wipe out our assailants, I had conceived a daring new life plan for us." And he goes on saying he wants to conquer the country, and a little while later openly admits that he realizes that Necra has been forced to serve him his entire life. We'll cover the end of the story quickly. It's very rare for me to read dialogue out like this, but I feel like this is such a weird, odd time capsule. Important. Chase, do you want to start here? Tell us your thoughts on this origin story, whatever you would like to share.
I thought about it. So I'm giving my commentary as I'm going through it. So I'm like, oh, damn, you know, the first thing I saw, even before I saw anything, it's like they cut to the flashback and I was like, I know this ain't a black woman cleaning with a bonnet on in the background, you know? So I was like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing right now, right? So we're jumping right into it. And then when I read exactly what was going on, I was like, okay, so wait a minute. The worst thing that their parents fear, what, a black baby? Because at first he didn't even look like an ape. He just was like a little black child, you know? And then they just dropped the little homie off in the desert. You know, like that was intense. Yeah, that was intense. And his dialogue was crazy, but the thing that I noticed was the thing that you mentioned was I was like, you know, first off, it's like it's odd to me that like the white male is turned into a black male, but takes the form of an ape. Right. Which goes back to that whole thing that I talked about earlier. I was just like, word, that's what's happening. And then the black girl turns into a white vampire, which I really can't figure out. I have questions on. So it's like, does she have European features? Like, there's so many questions that I have, and a lot of that goes into like the art of it as well.
They
like,
later call comics. Her. They later call her albino, by the way.
Mm. Okay, so I was thinking she's basically albino, but you know, I don't know anybody. Well, actually, I've met a few albino people, right? I don't know if they were ostracized per se, but you know, outside of her wild, you know, crazy Dracula hairline that they gave her, she was just albino, you know. So that wasn't too crazy for her to be ostracized, and it didn't feel equal to me because it was like, so she just becomes a white vampire. So even in their mutation, that's still cooler. You know what I mean? They drew her to be cute and lovable and all of that stuff. So I thought that was wild as a choice.
And then it's under this weird, he's kind of saying like, look, the black white kid was ostracized by white people and the white black girl was ostracized by black people. Look, we're the same. It's really rough when you try to see what he's trying to do there. And I hate it because it's very manipulative.
And I get that, but it doesn't, it's not the same. To me, you know what I mean?
Oh, so, clearly it's not the same.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And so, you know, that was my first thought. Also, like looking up a little bit of Necra's powers as well, where it's just like, you know, she gets stabbed with the pitchfork, but essentially she gets stronger the angrier she gets, which just goes back to like black stereotypes that you saw during Jim Crow and like all of that stuff post-slavery of just this is black people are aggressive and all of the things that we've seen in the history, you know, of the United States. So it all kind of is informed here. And even if subconsciously, you know, him weaving that stuff in, I thought that it was just like, wow, you know, so, but it makes sense in terms of like the times, I guess, you know, being the 70s when this was released. So, but going back even to the last thing I'll say about it is a lot of, and it's hard to say because every face, to me, every face comes from Africa, right? That's the way I feel. It's turned to just, you can find every face there. But I also have always seen an issue. They don't draw subtleties of black people's features. So that was what threw me as well. Cause I was like, did she just become a white woman? Right? Did she just become European in that sense? So that was strange. And I thought it was going to make me feel a little bit better as well. Cause the previous pages, we saw her commanding these black women to basically, she sent them on suicide missions. They didn't even know, right? She just blew them up. And she commands this army of black women that are, and I was like, I cannot believe it's another thing where white people are controlling this army of black people to do their bidding, et cetera, et cetera. But she's black. And I thought it would make me feel better, but it didn't make me feel better because it's just so ridiculous.
Two groups of characters.
Wildly racist and hilarious at the same time. Like if this was the episode of Black Dynamite, this should have been fucking fire. You know what I mean? It'd be fire. Like, I'd be like, oh, I feel way differently about this, you know, because this is satire. But the fact that this was canon at some point, you know.
There's two episodes of extreme violence in this. One is when the two black women blow up in the police station. And then we have these two mutant children murdering a group of white bigots. Emma, did you have thoughts on this scene where their powers manifest?
I mean, I'll be honest, I think the power of hate is kind of awesome. Like, if they did this well, I would have been super into Necra. I mean, like, I kind of am. So I'm really glad when you say that she's actually kind of been revitalized and updated because
she has some rough stories, but she's an amazing character.
That's cool because I do think that there's a lot of charm there. And like Chase was saying, especially if she is more like albino, that's a whole other conversation. It's actually a topic that's interesting to talk about because there are issues with that, you know, and I remember reading articles about how albino Africans have been hunted down and slaughtered because they believe that there's magical parts to them. I mean, there's just so much controversy, but that would be something that would be great to explore with a character like her. Instead, we just have the stereotypical hate. Now, don't get me wrong. I love watching kids murder bigots. I think that I could watch and read that all day long. I think it's hilarious, but it's actually really tragic and sad because they're like 16, I think, at this point. At least Mandrill is when he's talking about it. And of course, that realization that she's actually just been controlled by his pheromones this whole time just actually just makes me super sad for her. So I don't know. It's complicated from my perspective where I just wish people would do better, honestly.
if it makes you guys feel any better, we learn off panel in another issue that Necra murdered both Shanna's diamond mining father and her Irish Indiana Jones boyfriend, like in a previous issue. I don't know if that helps at all.
Nice. Chase is right. If this was done as satire, I'd be all over this, but
yes, if this was comedy, this would be right up my alley because this shit is hilarious. But
I think
it's not.
for a white person in 1974 who thought they were telling some sort of poignant story, I think what this is being written as more than anything is like an early 70s horror film. Because we have a murdering character who looks like a vampire and a murdering character who controls your mind and looks like a monkey. And when you read this as like, again, like a Blackula type film from the 70s with like that level of makeup, you can kind of see that's the effort that's being put in. Mandrill kind of rips his shirt off and fights with Daredevil. He's like, you'll either join me or else. And Daredevil's like, no, and calls him Mandy. Mandrill then lifts Daredevil up and just chucks him out the window. Daredevil spins around on a flagpole, jumps back in. There's a little fight on the streets. Mandrill ends up getting away. And it's a setup for the next issue, which... surprise X-Men fans, because this is where we go next, and I don't think anybody takes time to realize this. Next issue is the first appearance of the Silver Samurai, which is insane, who is a character from X-Men 97.
It's interesting, especially looking at the backstory part of it, and I'll be the first to throw out there, my naive privileged white ass was reading the original part of that backstory. And of course, like I wrote nice stereotypes or whatever about the black cleaning lady and the white scientist. But in my head, until I got to the next panels, I didn't think this for too long. I was sitting there going like, oh, those must be his parents. He had a black mom and a white dad in the 40s. How progressive. I was like, oh, this is going to be his origin. And then it's like, oh, him and his white wife. And I was like, oh, this is a very, this is a very different story.
Fuck that up quick.
You know, right? And I think for me, like to sort of like Emmett kind of hit on this, like, and we talked about that, like I was sort of on board with their partnership of like, I mean, regardless of their origins and the racist nature of like creating them, that they had found this partner of like, because yes, what they dealt with, the hatred they dealt with, the ridicule and all that was not equal in you know the same ways. But they were still both ostracized. And so finding each other, I was like, oh, cool. Like they recognize someone else who has been alienated for whatever reason. And for me, that's a huge part of what is a draw for X-Men, you know, like, and things like that is like people are ostracized for different reasons and of varying degrees, obviously. But then all of that is completely undone with like, oh yeah, no, she was only helpful to me because I have this power over women. And it's weird because he says that like he felt the only honest empathy he had ever felt from anybody. But then he talks about how it was because of his mutant power. Like, you know, in other worlds and other versions of this story, I would almost love to investigate him and the psychological effects that would have on him, that here he was thinking that this person cared about him. Finally, someone didn't see him as Monkey Man. She saw him as who he was and whatever and liked him. And then to realize, oh shit, she only liked me because I had a power over her. Mm-hmm. Like that could be some really interesting stuff in our
In the Necra trial, which is the next episode out after this, we're doing Necra and the Deadly Nightshade together, both of whom are early 70s characters that have very problematic beginnings, but who are incredible characters who have been portrayed more recently in recent years in amazing ways. Necra has a lot of stories, but one of the things I point out in my write-up there, and anytime I'm doing write-ups for those shows, it feels like a college thesis, is we've never gotten the Jessica Jones story for her, which is the I lost these years of my life to someone else. Necra is the magic crazy lady. She's the cult leader. She's the mass murderer. She's the voodoo woman. And then on Krakoa, she becomes something very different. And it's only in the recent years of comics we've got that more sympathetic portrayal of her. When we need black characters, or excuse me, we need black creators using these black characters, because that's the only way to make the magical. However, the reason I chose to do this on my show, this is 1974. Storm first appears in 1975. And I think we needed to have this conversation to show why it was such a big deal when Storm came along, and what a goddamn blessing it was that Chris Claremont was the one writing her. Because there's some problems along the way, but my word, is she a very different character and treated with a different type of love. I'm so grateful to each of you for taking this journey with me today. This show always leaves us with feelings. This is one of those issues where I just met strangers and asked you to read this. So thank you for your trust. And your willingness to come talk comics on this podcast. Whenever I have you on, it's just kind of whatever issue's next, but this is a rough one, and I really appreciate you all reading it with me. I'd love to hear any of your final thoughts as we're wrapping up. We're going to put this out on July 22nd. Where can people find each of you online, and is there anything you would like to plug? Let's go in the order of Emmett, Sean, and then Chase.
Oh, sure. No final thoughts on this one. It was definitely interesting enough that I snuck into the next issue and then got immediately jealous for the next team of people who get to talk about Silver Samurai with you.
I love Silver Samurai.
I'm so ready. But but this has been absolute fun. And if anything, it just reminds me of how much I love reading comics, even if they are problematic. It's a blessing to be able to go back and actually dissect them and say, how can we do this better? Because that is one of the things that we do on X-Men 97. Not everything is necessarily as updated as it should be. So it's nice to take a modern eye to these stories and just plus them where we feel like it just really helps, especially when you know that maybe no one meant anything maliciously, but we can do better. But I'm on Instagram. I mean, it's really just me sharing photos of my pets. But I hope people can just find me through my work. Honestly, I like just telling stories.
It is a joy to meet you. However, I do think there was some malicious intent in this issue.
Fair, totally fair.
Sean,
I think so. Final thoughts. It's definitely interesting. It is interesting to look back at the times, quote unquote, you know, and like look how far we have come in some ways, but also how far we haven't come in others. That when you can look back at things and be like, that's still there. I'll say this. One thing I was happy about, even I do really like the thought behind the character of Necra and being fueled by hate. I also went forward into the next issue, and I'll show it to you guys. But for anyone, if you look at the next issue and go to, I think it's like page 12 is my favorite panel ever of Necra as she attacks Daredevil and just screams, hate! As in one word.
Please go back and read Shanna the She-Devil 5. There are five pages of Necra that are iconic, that are burned into my brain. They're amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful. However, it does make me very happy that is not a real superpower in our world, because I feel like there are far too many people who would be far too strong being fueled by their hate. And Chad, I'm really happy and excited to hear that Necra has been done properly. And I'm sort of excited now to look forward into that, because I think that is an interesting character. I don't know how you could really do Mandrill properly, and I hope no one even tries. Because I think the comparison to Purple Man is very strong, except plus racism. So like, we've already done Purple Man well in representation. I thought that, you know, Tenet representation in Jessica Jones was amazingly terrible as a person. Mm-hmm. But so having that plus, you know, racism, I don't know if we need it. But Necra is cool. And so I'm intrigued to see where that will go. As far as me, I'm on Instagram. I'm terrible at Instagram. I think the majority of what I had ever done was pictures of me in various X-Men hats before episodes aired of our show. And if people went back and look at them, you can see that I'm actually wearing a hat that signals something about that episode. I think my favorite one is before 109, I had a red hat with a purple X. So it's Magneto's colors, but if you look closely, it has a Wolverine slash through the X.
Nerd.
So, right? Super nerd. And those, you know, I only wore 10 of my 20 some odd X-Men hats. So I've got some for season two and can wear some original hats there. But yeah, you can find me at Ganka, which is G-A-N-T-K-A. But it's not, I promise it's not as interesting as you might hope. And I don't talk a lot about behind the scenes of the show because I make schedules and budgets, and those are not exciting for people to see.
A quick thought on what you just said. I think the only way to do Mandrill right is to make him a fun character, but also do something to change his complete portrayal. He has to be the character who's trying to use his powers honorably. You know, like they did a storyline with Sinister where he just mentions out loud, like, yeah, I genetically spliced my racism out of me. It doesn't serve me anymore. And then it kind of makes the old stories like a different character in a way. Zeb Wells recently wrote the character Empath, who's also like emotional control, as a character who, like, if you grew up with this power and this is what you're developed and people just do what you say all the time, what kind of person does that make you?
Yeah.
And I think there are some interesting ways to do those stories, but you would have to very delicately erase or address these parts of his history because he's a reprehensible character. Often they just draw him as the bouncy monkey man in the circus suit, you know, this is his beginning and it's rough.
And I think the representation, like we were talking about earlier, of that, like the psychoanalyzation of him when he's realizing, oh, these people don't want to be in my life. They're in my life because they have to be because of these pheromones or this power that I have. And then to your point, like sort of acting against it or trying to use that as reasonably or responsibly, but also like that, like reflection on, like, that would be an interesting, I don't know how interesting it would be in the world of superhero comics, you know, to be like, this woman, I thought she was my friend, but really she only loved me because I'm a mutant.
Because of my musk.
Right? Yeah. Like that's...
There is a great short X-Men story where Emma Frost kicks the Mandrill's ass, and it's really satisfying. Chase, over to you.
Final thoughts. Well, I wouldn't mind taking a stab at Mandrill, given, like, I do think that that's great. A great story to try to balance, you know, as far as, you know, is this person in my life because they want to be or because they have to be? And also exploring what it feels like to look so different as well, you know, especially if that's something that would, if affected people to the point that it traumatized you, how would that affect you psychologically? Would you hide yourself? You know, do you wear the hood because you're ashamed of what you look like? You know, all those kind of things. I think it would be kind of interesting to explore. However, it wouldn't be my first priority per se. I do enjoy being reminded about the importance of Black people telling Black stories and is fleshing out Black characters so that there's a level of authenticity there to our experience. In that regard, I enjoyed reading the comic. I will continue reading this run because I have to find out what happens now as well. So that was cool. I'm glad that we were able to do this actually, because it gives me some, I need new content. I've torn through every single thing that I have right now at this moment in time. So that's exciting. So as far as where you can find me, I'm on Instagram just like everybody else. You can find me at Saint Chase. That's S-A-I-N-T-C-H-A-S-E. That's at most places. I'm on Twitter as well, which is a cesspool. But, you know, if you want to come, you know, jump in the mud occasionally, I pop in and pop out. I teach twice a week on projectcity.tv and interact with the community monthly there as well, and work on personal projects and things of that nature. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
It's just tremendous to have the three of you on. I'm so extraordinarily grateful for the three of you and for everyone who has joined me for these conversations. You guys, if you listened to the previous episodes, there's a moment where Guy Agostini is like, what did you have me read? Like, you don't read comics. What is this? Like, everyone who just comes in and is willing to come on this show with me, I appreciate you so much. Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The three of you are welcome to add me. Just reach out. Next out on the show after this is going to be the trials of Necra and Nightshade. We have an incredible jury assembled. It's going to be a fantastic conversation. I'm so honored that we are having it here. And then we'll wrap up the show at the end of the month with the final two parts of this storyline. And I've got some incredible guests lined up there. We're also featuring women of color over on the Patreon channel. So right after this, watch out for an episode with Tippi Starchild and I talking all about the incredible character Bling. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you to Chase, Emmett, and Sean for your time today. We'll see you all back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.